Okay, our next matter is docket number 82038, State versus Manson. Manson, are you ready?
Yeah.
All right.
I can again please reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay.
Alexander Ten, on behalf of the Appellant, State of Nevada. May it please the Court. At Mr. Manson's challenge hearing, his counsel asked Dr. Jones-Forster the question, are you saying that just because he has intellectual disability that he should not be held accountable for his current charges? Jones-Forster's response, no, not at all. I'm not saying he should not be held accountable for his current charges. I am merely saying that his lack of competence, intellectual disability, his neurocognitive difficulties, and his clear lack of understanding of these matters should all be taken into account and weighed when decisions are made with regards to this case. However, Dr. Jones-Forster was testifying in a challenge hearing where the crux and ultimate point of her testimony was to advocate her belief that Mr. Manson was incompetent without the possibility of restoration. If her finding were true, the only result was for dismissal of the charges. The only thing that could happen to Mr. Manson was that he would not be held accountable for the charges.
Now, he could be civilly committed in that instance, correct?
He could, but I'd like to discuss that, Justice Stiglitz. Okay. So in order to be civilly committed, though, the state would have to make a petition that not only was he danger to himself and potentially, he had an imminent danger to himself and potentially others. Now, yes, there's a statute that provides for that, but in this particular case, the charges that he was facing were sex assault with a minor under 13. It was merely because of their age. He was 18, she was 13. It wasn't a traditional sense of we're worried that he's going to perhaps go in and do something horrific in a public place or showing danger to himself or others. So my concern is, while that is a possibility, I'm not sure that if the state had made a petition, we would have been able to satisfy the requirements of that statute, because I don't know that there was evidence of this imminent harm. Now, I do believe even some of the evaluators in this case determined that there was not imminent harm, so that we could file a petition, but it's unlikely we would have prevailed on that. So ultimately, the only realm to deal with this case would have been in the criminal case, not with the civil commitment proceeding. Were the facts different in this case, perhaps there would be an argument to be made. And certainly, again, I believe everyone here has seen their share of individuals with psychological issues. There obviously could be cases where there's an individual who should be committed, and perhaps the criminal justice realm isn't the best realm for them. But I don't believe that that's what we have in this particular case based upon the evidence that we have regarding his intellectual competency to proceed. Now, here, similar to the other case, there were a number of things that the defendant was competent enough to do. He met this individual on Facebook, so he can use Facebook, he can meet up with her. He knew what a sexual relationship was. He knew that, he knew what protection was. And he talks about sexual protection, he talks about that in his evaluations, and he talks about that with the police. And in fact, according to the police report, the mother's main problem with this issue was that he was having the sexual relationship with her daughter, but that it was also unprotected. And he realized that he could have a baby if he had unprotected sex. And despite the fact that he's 18 and she's 13, and there's never an allegation that she wasn't willingly in this relationship, the problem is that they knew these were all possibilities, but based upon their age, that's the problem. One of the things that Dr. Jones-Forster has talks about when she talks about his ability to aid is, well, he didn't understand the idea of consent. Now, there I would say that that's an irrelevant consideration in this case. Why? Because consent wouldn't matter when it comes to these charges. The fact of the matter is it was their age. It was not her desire to be with him or his desire to be with her or their idea that they thought they were in love. That's not the issue. The issue is, can an 18-year-old have sexual relations with a 13-year-old? And that's simply not okay. So when Dr. Jones-Forster, and that's by the statute, one of the things Dr. Jones-Forster says is, well, he doesn't understand. When we get this idea about rational understanding, what does that mean? She argues, well, he doesn't understand why it's wrong. I would submit that many of the defendants who enter the criminal justice system might not agree with the laws as they're written, might not understand why the law is what it is. But here, the state has an interest in protecting 13-year-olds from being subjected to sexual relations with those that are above the age.
Mr. Chen, how would you define rational understanding? What's your definition of that?
I think the rational understanding is that they understand and are willing to understand the proceedings. So it's basically the language as it is, Justice Stiglitz. I think rational understanding is that they understand what it is. It's not, hey, what are you being charged with? Oh, I think I killed somebody. Well, you know, you're only here for a sexual assault on a minor. That's not killing somebody. There, I would say there's no rational understanding. There's no understanding, period. Here, we have an individual who, again, I'm mostly relying on Dr. Jones-Forrest's report because that's the report that was relied upon. You have an individual who clearly understands what the crime was, is willing to work with his attorney, certainly doesn't understand more nuanced and complex things, as Dr. Jones-Forrester said. But I would say the understanding that Dusky requires is exactly that, that you know why you're there, that you don't believe you're there for some other purpose, and that you're able to assist your counsel. Ultimately, the fact that, I would actually also say, when Dr. Jones does some of her follow-up questions, I myself wasn't sure what I would say if I were in that position. I mean, she asked some questions like, if the charges go away, what does that, or if you win at trial, what does that mean? And he says, well, I think I get to go home. What other significance does that have? And then she criticizes him for saying that he can't say anything else beyond the fact that he would go home if he wins at trial.
Do you think there's any validity to her opinion, to that doctor's finding?
I equate it to something like this, Justice Stiglitz. If you're watching your team, for instance, in a sporting event, and there's a referee call, and you see the call and you say, you know what, for my sake and for what the outcome that I want, I hope that this is the call that ultimately happens. But in looking at the TV and trying to be objective, maybe I could see how it's not the right call. I think Dr. Jones-Forrester, who made her neuropsychological evaluation before he ever even went to competency restoration proceedings, had an outcome that she believed was appropriate for this particular individual. And despite the contrary evidence, despite the improvements where his test scores drastically improved while he was at Stein, she wanted to ultimately see this outcome. And she had a reason to justify it because he couldn't answer certain questions that were posed of the defendant.
But you would concede, though, that she did do things that we would see in traditional competency analysis, correct?
I think, yes.
And made reasonable findings on those things. It's just you think that there are things far and above that that she also applied or overlaid onto this.
And that's where I believe that her emphasis on rational understanding went beyond what Dusky requires.
But then isn't that up to the district court to decide that?
And normally that would be, Justice Silver, which is...
Well, going forward, if a defense expert says X and the state says Y, I mean, that's the prosecutor's ability to cross-examine that expert and to show where they fail and that they're not presenting it pursuant to Dusky. And doesn't, at the end of the day, the district court make the call? If we're to reverse this, how do we reverse this?
I think it gets reversed based upon the fact that the district court abused its discretion in relying upon information that was clearly beyond a Dusky standard. Certainly, if the court gets the law wrong, I think that this court or any appellate court would have an ability to indicate you got the law wrong. And this is what Dusky really means. And when we say rational understanding, this is what we're talking about, not this complex understanding that the district court relied upon. And that's where I feel it abused discretion.
Okay. I want to go the same question I had with Adams, which is looking at Judge Bell's written order. You've kind of isolated that the finding of consent, the ability to understand consent, is immaterial because it is strict. I mean, if you are 18 and you have sex with a 13-year-old, consent is irrelevant, whether she wanted to do it or not. What else in her order was out of bounds in terms of, like, it doesn't matter, that should not be a factor, whether he understands the reasons for or nuances of the 13-year-old can't consent?
I would certainly say everything with regards to aiding his ability to aid his counsel, because there as well, I believe she talks about how he would not always ask the right questions, or he would not always know what to do. But again,
we've all had clients like that, yeah.
And many of the strategic decisions are left to the competent defense attorney, who will take the knowledge and be able to take, look, this is what I'm dealing with. I'm dealing with an 18-year-old who potentially had a sexual relationship with a 13-year-old. How can I best defend that? And as long as they're able to give some of that information, the defense is the one who's strategically responsible for...
Right, but you're trying to persuade us that she abused her discretion, either in the findings she made that were unsupported, or legally applying an incorrect standard. And I understand your consent issue. Is there anything else specific like that that you think was not proper for her to rely on, and the removal of it in her analysis undercuts the legitimacy of her findings?
Yes, Your Honor. In this one, actually, I forgot that he was also determined not to even understand the charges against him. That was one of Jones Forrester's findings, after Jones Forrester's findings, was that he doesn't even understand why he's there, because he doesn't understand the purpose of the crime. Not that he doesn't understand that having a sexual relationship with someone is improper. So right there, in this particular case, all three prongs were found to have not been met by the district court, and that's an absolute error in terms of what the evidence is in this case.
Mr. Chin, you can disabuse me of this, but here's what I want to understand. I think we're conflating the legal and the factual, because it would seem to me that, again, correct me if I'm wrong, that she found certain facts and she applied them to the Dusky standard and found not competent, not, you know, reasonable probability. So is it that you don't like the facts that she found, or you don't like the application? Because she can apply Dusky. The question is, and if it's, I don't think she should have found those facts, just because I may have found different facts or I may have given different weight, how is that an abuse of discretion? So sorry, that's a little jumbled, but that's what I'm trying to understand.
It's an abuse of discretion because let's just assume that she hadn't applied the Dusky standard. We would all say, yeah, she made factual findings, and she made findings about this individual, and maybe he's slow and he has other issues, but it wasn't the right standard because Dusky is the one that applies to competency proceedings. And what our argument is, yeah, she is free to consider different types of evidence. However, at the end of the day, the standard that applies to this is Dusky, and it's our position that she didn't apply that standard. You can use the words, but still not apply the standard, and that would be our position. Thank you.
Well, to go one step further and to tag along to that question, when it comes to the ultimate determination that Mr. Manson is not capable of restoration, the discussion by the judge on page 4 and 5 says simply, at the challenge hearing, Dr. Jones Forrester testified that Mr. Manson's low IQ and non-cognitive deficits would be lifelong disabilities. Mr. Manson's educational shortcomings may be improved upon the literacy, numeracy, and writing training, but Mr. Manson's intellectual and non-cognitive deficits would significantly limit the range of any improvement. Based on Mr. Manson's lifelong intellectual and non-cognitive deficits, the court finds that Mr. Manson is incompetent without the possibility of restoration. That's it. That's all it said. I think we should be requiring our district courts to say more if you're going to dismiss a criminal case and say that it's not possible to restore someone's competency, where there is a fairly substantial record by other experts showing that that has happened.
And
in this case, this individual's IQ is 70 or 67, whatever it is.
I would briefly just say, I agree that all of that came out, and much of our brief was about our own expert, the Stein's experts, but I would again point out that even in Dr. Jones Forrester, so rely upon the defense report itself, she acknowledges that there were progresses made. Now, she discounts the significance of that progress. So yes, he was able to do better. We appreciate the Slater method. He was testing better, but in reality, he just didn't understand it. And that's where we feel to rely upon that. That's an abuse of discretion, Justice Hardesty. Thank you.
And I'm going to offer you 2 minutes. You should into your time pretty well, and I'll offer your opposing colleague two additional minutes as well.
Good morning. Melinda Simpkins, Deputy Special Public Defender, and Daniel Page, Deputy Special Public Defender, appearing on behalf of George Manson in this case. May it please the court, we believe, contrary to what the state has been arguing, that there is actually substantial evidence in support of Judge Linda Bell's decision in this case. We believe the Dusky standard was properly applied, and that the state conflates the argument in their argument, they conflate the legal standard with the evidence. And here we also believe that the state uses a minimal, not a reasonable degree of rational understanding that is required by Dusky. With regard to the questions that the court asked, we believe the state should bear the burden of proof that incompetence is presumed and the state will be the party rebutting, so they should bear that burden. And the burden should be clear and convincing evidence, which if I get to, I'll give you more detail on that. Here the state's argument that Dr. Jones-Forrester used too high a standard, and then the district court adopted that that too high a standard, like I say, conflates the evidence with the legal standard. The district court, I believe, is entitled to rely on raw intelligence, education, and attorney-client interaction. The experts are asked three questions under 178.455. There is no authority that I could find that limits what the expert can look at in making their determination or the methodologies they can use in offering their opinion, and that is the evidence that the district court looks at. The issue in Calvin actually was that the district court limited the experts in what they could look at, and this court found that that was error. The experts do their evaluations, they offer an opinion, and that opinion is evidence. But the experts are not bound by Dusky. They are trying to answer the three questions set forth in 178.455. And in fact, the only entity that is bound by Dusky is the district court. And here it was Judge Bell. She is encouraged by this court, and in fact, the experts are encouraged to look for a wide range of evidence. And by the Calvin decision. So the state's argument that the district court simply adopted what Dr. Jones-Forrester said and that Dr. Jones-Forrester used too high a standard conflates the evidence with the legal standard. And the state here, if they found or thought that a neuropsychological testing and attorney-client interaction was improper for the district court to consider, then they probably should have objected at the hearing, and they didn't do it. Judge Bell's determination is entitled to deference on appeal because it is supported by substantial evidence. And the state in their brief cited to the unpublished Pigeon decision, where this court found it was substantial evidence because the district court relied upon the number of doctors and the time those doctors spent with the defendant. But here we have so much more evidence that the district court relied on. We know that Tariq's ability to comprehend information, his attention, his mental tracking, and his processing were all impaired. And these are important factors to discuss when he goes to trial, because as Dusky indicates, he is supposed to be able to aid counsel throughout these proceedings, and trial is included in that. His executive functioning is impaired, and that includes his ability to conduct abstract and deductive reasoning and problem solving. Again, all factors that need to be considered when you're talking about rational understanding. His neurocognitive function directly impacts his comprehension. And if he doesn't understand something, he is not going to be able to aid his attorney. The district court here relied on unrefuted evidence. And as we know from the Ninth Circuit decision in Hosky, it's clear error to give less weight to unrefuted evidence of incompetence. Steinbachers did know neurological testing. Although they agreed that he was intellectually disabled, they disputed the effect of that disability. I submit that if you don't know the degree of the disability, then your conclusion as to the effect of that disability is questionable. Also, Dr. Jones-Forrester here did an attorney-client evaluation. She observed Tariq interact with Mr. Page. Stein didn't do that. I believe Dr. Bossi said he had enough information to reach his conclusion.
Let me ask you the same question, Ms. Simpkins, that I asked Ms. Westbrook, though. Do you have any concern moving forward for that to become somehow a standard tool that should be utilized when, in many occasions, it would seem that that observation of attorney-client interactions could be used against the client?
Not really, Your Honor, because I believe, and forgive me, I'm the appellate attorney, I don't usually do this, but I think that really can't be used against our client. My major concern would be, could it be used against the client in the criminal case? And I don't think it can. I think it's prohibited from that use.
Obviously it's just about competency, but it's still utilizing information generated by the attorney-client interaction mm-hmm. against the client in terms of mm-hmm. finding them competent and then maybe sending them to court to face a life sentence, right?
Right.
I mean, it would still seem to me to be problematic for that to be a standard thing, putting defense attorneys in that position of monitoring their interactions to guard against the use of that.
I don't really think.
Well, to follow up on Justice Herndon's question, so an incompetent individual is waiving their right to attorney-client privilege?
No, Your Honor.
What
I'm saying.
What?
Let me.
Okay.
What I'm saying is.
I accept the friendly amendment, by the way. So please go ahead and answer both of those.
Thank you, Your Honor. What I'm saying is that what the evaluating doctor is going to be looking at is the client's ability to understand the information that I'm giving them. I am not necessarily setting forth my entire defense at that point in time, because obviously that's something that I do as the attorney. But I would be very concerned if I were evaluating or if I were the attorney. The defendant gets to answer three questions throughout this process. And that is, are we going to trial? Am I going to testify? And should I take a deal? So I think that the focus should be really to give, because I'm not expecting these evaluators to go into everything that I am going to be telling my client. But three major issues like that, I need to ensure that my client understands. And so I would probably be focusing my interaction with my client on that issue. And
Ms. Simpkins, but isn't it, I mean, does the client themselves before trial need to be able to articulate now all the reasons why they may want to testify or not want to testify, as opposed to getting into the trial, they get to the point they have to make the decision. Counsel will meet with them, talk about the pros and cons. And
not at this point, not prior to trial, but one of the major considerations, because most, as we all know, most criminal trials end up settling.
Okay.
One of those major considerations that I would expect to go over in a competency evaluation is my client's understanding of that process. And Tariq just did not have that here. Does that make sense?
I don't know, because if the counsel, I mean, he was able to talk about, you know, what kind of a deal might be acceptable and what kind might not. And it's all in the abstract because there isn't an offer on the table when you're having that conversation. So it's not unexpected that someone with his IQ might not be able to talk about it in the abstract. But if there were an offer on the table and Mr. Page met with them and explained, this is the offer, this is why I think you should take it, or this is why I don't think you should take it, would he not be able to listen to that and make a decision, as opposed to talking in the abstract about why anyone in the criminal justice system might want a deal or not?
If I could answer your question with an example.
Uh-huh.
In this case, and I believe it was Justice Stiglitz that asked, what exactly is the definition of rational understanding?
Yes.
We know, if I have a client who knows what their speedy trial rights are, okay, they know they want a speedy trial. That's a factual understanding. The question that, as a rational understanding, is do they have the ability to weigh whether it's in their best interest to exercise that right or to waive that right? So here, when we're talking about a speedy trial, that would be a rational understanding, an example. When we're talking about, I'm sorry, not a speedy trial, pleading guilty, mm-hmm. Tariq understands that if he goes for trial or he wants a trial, he has to plead not guilty. He understands that if he wants a plea deal, he has to plead guilty or no contest. Tariq also understands that a deal means he gets a lower sentence, okay? Mm-hmm. But he cannot make the deductive leap or use his deductive reasoning to determine what happens to his trial if he takes a deal. There's no evidence of that. He doesn't have that ability, according to Dr. Jones Forrester.
He knows he doesn't go to trial if
right,
he gets
but
a deal.
No, he knows that if he takes a deal, he gets a lower sentence. He doesn't understand that by entering a plea of guilty, he waives his right to a trial. That's the point I'm trying
to make. So if someone tells him that, then he'll know it.
Right, but he doesn't understand. He can't deductively reason. Usually that's not something I need to tell my client. You enter a plea of guilty, I don't have to tell them that you're not going to have a trial. So Tariq cannot independently make that deductive reasons. That's the concern, because we're trying to measure his ability to do that.
Right.
That was also a concern that was raised by the Stein doctors initially after his first 9 months of treatment, because he was in treatment for 15 months. And after the first 9 months, Dr. Bennett indicated he has no indication and he doesn't understand that a plea agreement requires what rights are required to be waived under a plea agreement. And
how many people come into the legal system able to work, tick off the five rights they're going to waive in their guilty
but
plea
you
agreement?
Some,
how many attorneys can
I'm not
do that?
Saying that, but I'm saying he's got to have some kind of basic understanding. Just think, when you do a plea canvas, okay? You expect, and I'm not even going into everything, I'm just the basic things. He's got to have some kind of understanding of what he did, because he's got to be able to tell you what he did.
Right.
He's got to have some kind of understanding of what his potential sentence is. He's also got to have some kind of rudimentary understanding of the concept of judicial discretion in sentencing, because he's got to know that by entering this plea, it's not binding on the court. There's a lot more stuff that the district court goes into, but there are certain basic things.
I would dare say 95% of criminal defendants come into the system not knowing that. Okay. Maybe if they are a repeat player, they know it. But
I don't think it's too much to ask, especially when you are trying to measure his ability to reason. And specifically, like I say, this was something that was raised by the Stein doctors that did after the first 9 months of evaluation. So if they had a concern about it then, and we have no evidence now that he has developed that ability, I would say that the state didn't meet their burden.
Didn't increase score some evidence that it did increase his ability?
I'm sorry, I couldn't.
The improved score that they, on the test they administer at Stein, and I can't say I have great familiarity with the test, but their position is that as a result of the so-called Swader method, which all seem to agree, all of the experts who testified seem to agree that was appropriate, mm-hmm. that after engaging in that method for this, yes, extended period of time, that he had significantly improved in his understanding.
He significantly improved. It's my understanding, and again, I don't have much understanding either, that it is a written test that he has to take. And that Dr. Jones Forrester kind of explained that when she did her neuropsychological evaluation, he has very strong rote memory skills, and he's very acquiescent, and he's very, friendly. He's a friendly guy. And so she thought that the way to explain that was because his rote memory is so good. And he wants to appear smart. He doesn't want to appear like he has problems. That could be a reason why the scores went up, or that the Stein doctors interpreted his answers to those questions that way.
Wouldn't that have been a pretty important finding for the judge to make in concluding that he could not restore competency?
That he had good rote memory?
Yeah.
Well, Your Honor,
or that his rogue memory supplanted his actual understanding, because that's not in these findings here.
No, but there was extensive questioning about it from Dr. Jones Forrester, and the Stein doctors did disagree with that. So it may be, I can't tell you it's not important. It may be important, but on the other hand,
as an alternative, you've asked us to provide deference to the district court here. And on this issue, mm-hmm. the inability of the defendant to restore competency, what deference should we give to the judge, to the record, since the judge didn't specifically reference the record, to his inability to restore competency? Where in the record is that supported? That's why I posed the question about rogue competency, rogue memory.
Well, Your Honor, if you look at Dr. Sharon Jones Forrester's evaluation, the state, and that is at the record beginning at volume one, page 72, the state puts great emphasis on the fact that Tariq knows what sex is, and he knows that he was trying to have a baby with her, and he knows how to work Facebook. But if you look at Dr. Jones Forrester's evaluation, she indicated that Tariq would never have a bank account. He would never be able to live alone. He would never be able to take care of his own hygiene needs without prompting from his parents. He is never going to be able to drive a car. So the fact, and all of this is contained in the record in Dr. Jones Forrester's evaluation. She goes into this in detail. So I think that is there to support the determination that Tariq will never reach the required level of restoration to competency as required by statute.
But you acknowledge that we need to follow the judge's order in order to evaluate the judge's decision making, not necessarily just what the doctor says.
I understand.
Obviously, as I said earlier, in both Adams and Manson, it is 100% verbatim, almost like a boilerplate, three-sentence summary conclusion in each case, no possibility of restoration without an examination of how we got there.
I understand your position, Justice Harder. Herndon, sorry.
You forgot me so quickly.
It's been a minute. I don't know that we expect district court judges to put every single factor that they are relying on in their orders. I mean, I don't think that is feasible. And so, and it wouldn't even come up if the state hadn't appealed. So, I mean, that would have been, so we're looking at, we have to submit the record on appeal to aid you in making that determination. Was there substantial evidence? I don't think the standard is, was there substantial evidence noted in the order? Does that make sense?
I understand what you're saying. I mean, but you know, the casual observer or even a judge, an attorney could read this and say, well, maybe the judge thought because they were lifelong problems, there's no restoration. And other people may say no, because of things in the record that aren't here, that's why she thought there was no chance of restoration. So you can't really evaluate.
I understand that. But I think that there was more than substantial evidence to support this decision. Maybe the order was inartfully drafted. It could have been drafted better, but at the end of the day, I think there was substantial evidence.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Appellant's appendix, page 141, testimony is Dr. Jones Forrester. Does he work? Yes, he works at Express Temper Pack. Can he take the bus? Doesn't he take the bus to work? Is that correct? Yes, he's able to take the bus. So we have an individual here who's not competent to face criminal charges, yet he's able to work, he's able to be in community, he's able to meet people, and yet this district court made the gravest consequence by dismissing a criminal case against an individual who otherwise is able to function in society.
Mr. Chen, that only highlights really the embarrassingly low standard we have for people in the criminal justice system. Because a kindergartner can drive a car if they can reach the pedals. So there's two things I want to focus on. One, we keep having this kind of red herring about observing the defendant. I think it's red herring. Talking to their client. Most competency questions are generated from defense counsel. They're the ones that bring it up because they're talking to a defendant and they're like, whoa, we're not communicating. And competency is something we're kind of, in the competency realm, all bets are off. It can't be used against them in a criminal trial within the competency realm because we need that honesty, we need that candor among the professionals. And so I don't know that somehow invades. Now we're talking a trade client and all that. That scab's ripped off in this context. But I struggle with, there's certainly to me, if it had come out the other way and the defense was here appealing and saying, you know, this is wrong. I think this would be an order out.
How can we say she abused her discretion? There's these doctors that say he's competent. And yet here we are because it came out the other way. And suddenly the whole, this is this, the grave sky is falling. It's all that instead of just what it would be ordinarily. A judge heard it all and made a determination that I would ask you, that may be supported by substantial evidence in the record. I don't know that we've parsed these orders in the same way when it comes out the other way. So I just want you to kind of comment. I'm sorry, I threw about four things at you. But
no, I understand what you're saying, Justice. And that was going into this, clearly from doing these appeals, I recognize that's our hardest burden, is that the district court in this case happened to go the other way. I couldn't find any case where this has happened, where the district court has dismissed a case without probability of restoration. And you know, I was looking at this unpublished case just a couple of years ago, Ashraf versus 8th Judicial District. And that defendant had significantly more mental issues, schizophrenic, potential delusions. I mean, this is someone who we're talking about had those issues in that particular case. It was found that he was competent. And sure, we did rely upon that and thought that it was appropriate. But I would say the difference with this case is, again, that the district court was able to make this decision and made the decision it did and probably believes the decision that it made. The issue, though, is when you apply the standard that the district court applied, when you take into consideration things that clearly are either belied by the record, including Dr. Jones Forrester's own report, I think that's where the problem is, and that's where we're arguing and asking for this court's intervention. Versus if this were potentially the Ashraf case and we had lost, it might not be one we appeal because it might be one where, hey, look, unfortunately, this person just needs other type of help. He needs to be committed under 433A. Like, that's a potential. But in this case, it's not there because this defendant had so many competencies, so many things that he was rationally capable of doing.
And yet the Stein doctors found him incompetent for a number of months. Correct.
Yes, they did. But they all had the key difference there was, yes, they felt that he could be better, but they all believed that he could be, there was a substantial, not just a probability, but a substantial probability that he could be restored.
So they felt he could be, and the other doctor felt he could not be. And so Judge Bell abused her discretion by believing the doctor who felt he could not be.
Yes.
Okay.
And not explaining why.
Or not explaining why and potentially also relying upon information that shouldn't be part of her decision. And one of the things Justice Pickering was asking was about the specific order. And one of the things that she has a problem with regards to his intellect is he believes that we have to have video or photo evidence of the alleged crime. Now, again, all of you are practitioners and have seen defendants who get upset about the fact that the state does not have video evidence. Where's the DNA evidence? Where's the physical evidence to convict me? You have none. So therefore, I should walk free. And why am I not OR today? We've all seen that individual. So all of a sudden, just Judge Bell is relying upon something that, again, so what if he has that mistaken belief? The fact of the matter is his competent attorney will let him know, hey, that doesn't matter. And even if he disagrees with his attorney still knows they can still convict you with it. And I'm going to tell you that they can convict you without physical or video evidence. But that's what her order relies upon. Facts like that. And not only to delay the case, but to ultimately dismiss the case. So where are we as a society when next time, hopefully not, but potentially it's not outside the realm of possibility that he meets another 13-year-old or someone younger. And ultimately, they're going to come before the court and say, well, he was found incompetent without the possibility of restoration. And somehow the state's going to have to overcome that burden.
Is that what we should be considering? I mean, does competency depend upon what the charge is in this context? I mean, you bring up the facts of each case. Where does that go in our determination of whether it was a proper competency evaluation?
I don't think that the charges shouldn't matter in regards to the standard of Dusky, but my concern is that when you apply it to this defendant, or you apply it to the defendant that we had prior to this case, when you see what that individual is capable of and all the evidence out there, and even Dr. Jones Forrester's own evidence to prove that they understand what's happening, and then to dismiss that case and make this grave and potentially lifelong because that's what she's saying. It's not even possible that he could be restored. To make this lifelong determination is essentially going to give that individual a carte blanche to do whatever in the criminal justice system. So I'm not saying that you should consider it because these charges are serious or the other charges were serious. I'm saying that as a matter of public policy, as a matter of what the actual evidence was in this case, there's simply no grounds to for the district court to have done what it did.
All right, colleagues, anything else?
Just have a question. I wish I'd asked Ms. Simpkins the same
Go
question.
Go ahead.
But where a case is dismissed without prejudice, based on this determination, how does the state ever bring the defendant back into the court system to determine competency? It seems like the suggestion that it's dismissed without prejudice is effectively a complete dismissal of the case.
I would certainly think if the same judge is sitting there, Justice Hardesty, that would obviously be problematic because I assume they'd have the same result.
Well, I don't want to point to a specific judge. I think the bigger problem is what does the next judge do in trying to assess competency when there's been a judicial finding that competency can't be restored? You effectively are precluded from prosecuting these people ever again.
I think that's the point that I finished on. I know that the statute provides for a mechanism for it to work, but in reality, that's obviously one of our main concerns here.
Yeah.
So, I mean, why not go to the DAs, go to the legislature and get that changed?
Potentially, it would be.
We have a statute in place allowing for this.
Yes. And theoretically, when I was answering the last question, I wasn't saying just this judge or whatnot, but ultimately there's going to be another judge in that seat.
Sure.
And that judge's perception of what it should rely upon obviously could be different from what the district court in this case was. But it's still problematic, and I would say certainly the defendant has a better argument having had a case dismissed without the possibility or probability of competency when it's happened before. So yes, there is a mechanism in place, but what would actually happen is probably wholly dependent upon what that judge's perception is.
Well, let me just follow up, if I might. If there's some miracle drug that is discovered that boosts IQ and comprehension in people with intellectual disabilities, these defendants particularly, if that happened and it were a murder case, the dismissal is without prejudice. So if they're restored to competency, even though they've been dismissed without prejudice, if all of a sudden they are, working at a very high level due to something that nobody foresaw, could they be retried? Could they be tried?
I think so. There has to be a material difference. But take, for instance, in this case, what if he does meet another 13-year-old girl?
No, I understand that point. I was just countering the other point.
But absolutely, as long as there's some type of change in circumstance. But I think we would be in a tough position if there was no change in circumstance, because there would be some deference probably given to the prior district court.
Right. I don't know what the law of the case would be. I haven't parsed through that.
Okay. Anything else?
Thank you.
All right. Thank you for the briefing and the arguments. Matter of stance, better we stand at recess.